You're at the Coaching Inn, 3D Coaching's virtual pub, where we enjoy conversations with people who are engaged in the world of coaching.
Welcome to this week's edition of the Coaching Inn. I'm Claire Pedrick, and today I'm in conversation with improviser and evidence-based coach Julie Flower. Now, I wasn't sure which way to say that, so that will make an interesting conversation in a moment. But just as we begin, a reminder, if you want to get every new episode as it drops, do subscribe or follow on the place where you listen to your podcast. That would make everyone do a happy dance. Thank you. So, Julie, welcome.
Hello. Hi, Claire. It's lovely to be with you.
So, you're an evidence-based coach and an improviser. Tell us a bit about your journey to this moment.
Oh, yes. So my original career was in leadership and management, primarily in the public services, in health management. And I decided about 12 years ago that I fancied doing some coach training because I'd benefited from coaching at work. And about the same time, I also happened to take a weekend improv course. And I immediately, just for fun, and I immediately started to see the overlaps and feel the overlaps. So really, since then, I've been both training and practicing as a coach, and I now teach coaching as well. And I've been training and practicing performing as an improviser. And I now teach improv as well, both occasionally to improvisers, but primarily integrating learnings, philosophy, practical exercises from improv within a leadership and team and coaching space.
I love how you've kind of learnt them at the same sort of pace.
Yeah, that was just serendipity, really. But it's been wonderful because I believe, and I'm assuming you do as well, but I won't put words in your mouth, that essentially the principles of coaching almost become like a philosophy of life. Yeah. And actually, I feel that improv can be like a philosophy as well, and that there is a lot of overlap.
You're putting words in my brain because I've just made made me make a connection, which I'm very grateful for, actually, because I do see coaching as a philosophy. And I think probably I do see improv as a philosophy, but I don't think I'd made the leap. Claire now goes off on a thinking process. Coming back, so I'm so curious that your life in this kind of world is really quite recent, 12 years. Mm. What did you do before that, apart from work in the public sector?
So, leadership and management career, history at university. So I suppose I went self-employed 13 years ago. So I've been self-employed just over half of my working life, which feels like quite a milestone, really, of self-reliance, if nothing else. And originally I was stepping into a space where I thought that I would do independent management consulting, basically, and associate consulting within a kind of public service, government, charity type space. But what was interesting, what very quickly edged me towards then incorporating coaching, was that I felt that consultancy lacked a lot in many ways, but I hated the idea that you just handed people a big PowerPoint pack and then went off without really supporting them and empowering them and motivating them to make change and embed change. And I feel that's where coaching can add kind of gold dust to consulting, as well as obviously being a hugely important intervention in its own right.
Yeah. So you do evidence-based coaching. Tell us a bit more about what you mean by that, Julie.
Well, I trained, one of my coach trainings was at Henley Business School, which very much has the philosophy around being eclectic and being evidence-based. So essentially seeking to build particularly aspects of psychology and psychological research into our practice, but very much is integrated, non-directive, person, focused coaches. So that's really where I'm coming from. And I think for me, that means that when I incorporate aspects of improvisation within coaching, I also have a mind to whether there is any evidence and what that might be to help us. Because I think coaching sometimes gets a bad reputation because anyone can call themselves a coach, as we know. It is unregulated, although there, you know, increasingly there is more accreditation and the professional bodies are doing great work in that space. But it can get a bad reputation and can seem superficial and can seem like people are wanting to exploit others. So I'm very clear that I'm interested in science. I'm interested in where it's come from. So that's my basis. I did history at university, so that makes me interested in evidence as well.
So what's the most interesting thing that you found with evidence this year? I'm curious.
Oh, with evidence this year, with respect to improvisation or
more? Well, either, because I'm interested in both sides.
Yeah, so I haven't had a big insight from an evidence base with respect to improvisation this year, although I've got some I can share. I'm just thinking more widely with respect to evidence. You caught me on the hop here, Claire. It's quite early in the morning. Let me think. What have I recently learned that would be useful? Just give me a moment. Because I quite like interdisciplinary work. And so even listening to the podcasts like All in the Mind from Radio 4 things like that, where I think, oh, yes, well, that's what it could mean for coaching. Well, that's what it could mean for how we work together. Which is the fascinating thing, really. I suppose, actually, this isn't new evidence, but I was reminded of it. I was reading an obituary of Daniel Kahneman the other day. And of course, such a huge thinker, including with his very famous book, Thinking Fast and Slow. And I suppose it just reminded me of the journey that psychology has gone on in, you know, moving into many aspects of our lives, including behavioural economics, and just thinking, always reminding ourselves that we are not really in control of our minds, and that these things show up, these cognitive biases show up wherever we are in whatever situation. And I think sometimes just reminding ourselves of that can be hugely helpful in terms of not responding too quickly and challenging ourselves, but also just maybe in cutting ourselves a bit of slack as well as humans.
Yeah, because perfection doesn't exist.
And it would be very boring if it did, or if we were all the same, right?
Yeah. Yeah, I said to someone the other day, for me, really growing as a coach and becoming an artful coach is making the distance between your worst work and your best work a bit smaller than it used to be.
I love that.
Because that's, yeah. So it's interesting what you said about All in the Mind, because that's how I learn. I learn by bouncing. So I'll be reading or listening to something, and then I'll bounce it back into the coaching space, which I find really interesting. But I am really curious now. Julie, tell us about the evidence base for improv.
Yeah, sure. Well, I think it goes into the bucket emerging. So there's very little evidence base in terms of research around improvisation in coaching per se, but there have been studies within psychology fields, within therapy space, and also more widely within leadership and management. So still quite early, most of them are over the past 10 years or so. But some of the interesting things that have been found, particularly within teams and within a leadership space, there are benefits of doing. So we're talking here, for instance, around engaging in improvisation exercises. So exercises that are drawn from improvised theatre and comedy that are typically used within groups to help them develop their skills to perform okay? But it's not about performance. It's not about being funny. That's not really what improv is about. Improv's about listening and collaborating and building on offers made by others. So what's interesting is when some of these studies expose people to those exercises, they saw benefits in terms of flexibility of thinking, in terms of positive affect, so actually emotional benefits there, in terms of collaboration, creative thinking, those sorts of areas. So beneficial potentially for how teams work together and beneficial for how humans interact both personally and within organisations. And then there has been some work within therapy, as I say, and there was a very good study from Israel where a number of clinical social workers went through, I think it was an 8-week course of improvisation exercises, so quite long in terms of the intervention. Often these things are like an hour or 2 hours. So they went through this and there were some significant changes with respect to sort of practitioner presence, which I thought was fascinating and which has great resonance for coaching, and then also feels like flexibility of thinking. So really areas that might be very helpful when transposed to the coaching space. And we know a lot of the research from psychology comes over then to coaching. And then alongside that, there was a study about 10 years ago now by Michael Reed that looked at improvisational moments within coaching.
Ah.
And he did surveys of practicing experienced coaches to see whether they thought improvisation was a relevant concept for coaching, which they decided it was, and also to identify what some of those moments might be where coaches really feel that they're in the moment, that they need to be very spontaneous, perhaps that they're feeling quite uncertain. Actually, what are those moments?
Yeah, because I always think about it in relation to developing the inner thing of the person. So we had our most recent on-site day on Friday, and we had 12 coaches. And the thing for me, immersing people in improv for a whole day, is it's terrifying. That's a good thing, because courage is an important thing. But what I notice as the day goes through is that the purpose of that, and it's interesting that it's over a whole day, so people come back to the same exercises or we do other ones. The thing that I notice most, and it'd be interesting if we did a bit of in and out questions to people before and after about what was the shift, but the shift that I see in them is that they begin to be able to stop the thinking that happens between the seeing and the offering. And then we're all a bit more in sync.
Absolutely. I think that idea of people stepping out of their heads to some extent, putting down some of the concerns about how people are perceived, maybe taking a few more risks appropriately, and actually just getting into their bodies, their emotions, some of that side of things. Yeah. So I do feel, I remember, because I did some research in this field, which I can share as well. I remember one quote, which was that improv is really other. It sort of almost provides you with some kind of awareness and experiential learning that is quite unique.
Because it's so not in your head. There's nothing in improv that's in your head, is there, except when it is and you have to try and get it out.
Yeah.
You and I spoke a few months ago, didn't we? And you kindly sent me a whole load of links about me doing some improv for fun. And I suddenly was contacted by somebody who said, there's an improv for fun course online. Yay. So I'm doing, So I'm doing an 8-week course at the moment. Today's week 3, I think.
Great.
And that's interesting because everybody's come for different reasons. They aren't coaches necessarily, although I think one or two of them probably are. But really noticing what shifts when you get outside of what's comfortable or what you think is in control is such an interesting thing, isn't it?
Definitely. And sometimes it can be a huge release. So when I did some research with experienced coaches as part of my MSc, one of the key findings was that there was this sense of emotional release from constraints. And for some people, that was actually really exciting, like a release from maybe some of the professional baggage that they got, for want of a better term, that they felt they could be more of themselves in the coaching space and less constrained. For some, there was almost a reaction that it was quite a negative reaction, not to the exercises, but actually to almost the fact that they had been constrained, that maybe they haven't in the past been as playful or as open as they felt they could be and should be. And I thought that was fascinating.
Yeah, stepping in when you don't know what to say, but you know it's the right moment to step in is a really artful thing, isn't it? One of the people that we had last week, one of the things that they said was that as an introvert, they'd expected not to show up.
Yeah.
But they showed up much more than they expected in the most beautiful and wonderful way. And there was something really releasing, I think, about it, which was lovely.
I think that's great. And when I work with people around these areas, one of the assumptions people make is that, oh, if I'm more extroverted, then I'll be better at this, whatever better means. If I'm maybe more introverted, I'm going to be drowned out or I'm not going to be into it. Whereas actually, given that improvisation is about genuinely listening, there's something about the power of silence. There's something about the power of taking time, and there's something about the power of not feeling you have to fill the space with words, which again is so powerful for coaching.
We did a game in my leisure class the other day about where we all had to speak in gibberish.
Yes, I love that game.
And you had to respond with your body and you didn't understand at all what was going on. And it was probably the best game that we played in that session, because everybody let go of the need to know. So we're hiring that improv teacher because he's so good online. We're hiring him to run a presence course for us online because he uses Zoom as a tool. So everyone else I talk to about improv online is kind of doing improv and doing it online, which is great. But this teacher uses the boxes as part of the thing. It's extraordinary. So we're having a conversation tomorrow about pinning it down. And it will be 6 hours, because there's something for me about doing it, feeling uncomfortable, getting a little bit less uncomfortable. And then getting uncomfortable again and getting less uncomfortable in a kind of iterative way, where the 1 or 2 hours are hugely valuable, aren't they? But the real immersion is exhausting and different, I think, probably.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. And it speaks to that kind of almost emotional rollercoaster that people do go through in, you know, almost by activity. There might be this, for some people, anxiety, and then joy or fear or exasperation, and then back again, and just experiencing that. And I think I was drawn to this the other day because I was running a workshop with coaches, and just the idea of difference in terms of how we experience and learn. So with one particular exercise, someone fed back that actually they found some of the wordy aspects harder, whereas of course other people found that easier. And just thinking about therefore that mix of exercises to help people almost have empathy as well for a variety of experiences, because again, I think as coaches, it's good for us to feel what it's like to be put on the spot, sometimes in a way that's less comfortable or more comfortable for us, because that's exactly what we're doing for our clients.
Yeah. That's why I did my one-to-one improv lesson with Heather O'Connor. That scared the absolute living daylights out of me, because we got onto Zoom and I'm going, what are we going to do? And she's being lovely. She was fabulous. But it was the most immersive way that I could be reminded or re-remember what it was like the first time I had a conversation with a coach when I wasn't one.
Yeah, and that's lovely. There's something very visceral, isn't there? Very experiential about just doing what seem quite simple activities.
Yeah, but it's just going into an hour when you don't know what's going to happen.
That's a brave thing, Claire. I don't know many people who would do a 1 hour one-to-one in improv.
It wasn't the plan. I signed up to a group and then there wasn't a group. And then I said no to the one-to-one, and then I spoke to our improv teacher, Stuart, and he went, no, go for the one-to-one, because really see what you can learn from it in terms of how you experience it. So, Julie, you have another life outside work.
Another life.
Yeah. Tell us about your show.
Yes. Yeah, so this is a kind of a build, if you like. Is it a build? So I do perform improv in my spare time, and I've taken things to Edinburgh as part of ensemble groups in the past sort of 3 or 4 years. So last year we took our robot and improv show, and we were on at the Gilded Balloon, and that went well. And I got kind of thinking about, I've had an itch for a while around maybe doing some writing, and I've had an itch for a while to explore a story, which is the story of my grandma, who ran a secondhand clothes shop in the centre of Sheffield for 35 years, from the early 60s onwards. And so those two things collided. As you can tell about me, I quite like to integrate different interests and aspects of my life. So I started thinking about this time last year, a bit earlier, around how I might produce a write and produce a solo scripted show about my grandma. So quite a few things when you hear the idea of performing solo. So feeling a bit of what you felt going into that one-to-one, and also writing a script. So I actually went on a really great, I think it was an 8-week course around developing a solo show with Katie Shute, who you might know, one of the Maydays, a great colleague and friend of Heather Urquhart. And that was great in starting off some of that process and really giving me a kick. And what I've been really enjoying is I've been doing kind of historical research about my grandma, and finding people's recollections of going in her shop, people I'd never met before, as well as then the writing process. And I'm fortunate to be working with a professional dramaturg director in order to develop this. So somehow it's going to be on at the Gilded Balloon in Edinburgh for the whole of August. So I will very quickly find out whether I've got the resilience to carry this off day after day, particularly if nobody turns up.
Wow, that's deep learning on so many levels.
Experiential, I think.
And so exposing. What a wonderful piece of learning.
Well, that's what I'm thinking and what I'm loving. Yeah, as I say, I'm loving the process, and I am trying to reflect on it and think of it as a real piece of learning and development. I'm very fortunate to have this opportunity.
I'm so interested what will happen to your coaching when you come back, apart from after you've recovered from being completely exhausted.
Yeah, I wonder. How will that be? Because I suppose one of the things I'm learning and reflecting on quite a bit at the moment is this sense of things never really being finished, but when is it finished enough? When do you sort of have to just make that leap? And I think that has quite an interesting analogy with coaching, and maybe with many of the situations our clients find themselves in, particularly if, you know, they have a tendency towards wanting things to be perfect. Or I often work with clients who are in really complex, kind of messy systems, dealing with really wicked problems, you know, kind of complex public service systems. So almost that sense that you have to accept that something is good enough and go with it and make the best of that and celebrate and learn from that, even though you can't control all this other stuff. I think that's quite an interesting learning. You know, I can't control whether or not people come to it. It's a very competitive field. I can do my best within my budget and my capability with marketing, etc. But, you know, I have to accept that that will or it won't be, you know, but what is within my control? And yeah, I think that's quite interesting.
Yeah, and there's something about putting yourself out there on every vulnerability, which I love.
Yes, I think I love it too. I think, yes, it's interesting. One of the things that spurred me along to do this was a year ago, one of our lovely coaching colleagues, Anne James, I was teaching with her at Henley. And she said, oh, Julie, I really want to sort of liven up the exercise around listening. Would you tell the group a story? Could you just tell them, you know, a 5-minute story? So I said, oh, okay. So I just briefly told a story about the fact I was thinking of developing this show and told them a bit about my grandma. And what I found fascinating was the range of reactions in the room, from people being tearful to people sort of remembering their grandparents, or to people being, you know, suddenly saying, well, hang on a minute, I was in Sheffield at that time, connecting on many different levels with many different things. And what I would love is to really, yeah, experience that range of audience reactions. And actually, I think that teaches me a lot about listening and about the assumptions we make when we, you know, deliver something, offer something, because everybody will experience it in different ways.
Yeah. So I saw on LinkedIn that you're doing some pre-shows. Just tell us where they are.
Oh, yes, thank you. So we've got Brighton Fringe on the 2nd of June at the Toy and Model Museum. We've got Tunbridge Wells Fringe in a lovely, it's called Green Duck, like a lovely sort of studio bar. That's on the 4th of July. That's an evening one. That's actually my grandma's birthday. And then,
oh,
I know, and then 7th of July in the afternoon, that's a Sunday, that's at the Tabard Theatre in Chiswick in London.
Nice. So if you're in the UK and any of those places, go along.
Please come along. It'd be great to see you.
And support Julie. And if you're in Edinburgh in August.
Yes, please do. Gilded Balloon, 12:20. So a very civilised time in the day.
Great. And the show's called?
Grandma's Shop.
Grandma's Shop. Mm-hmm. Oh, sounds so wonderful.
Thank you. I used to have her every Saturday.
Did you? And is she still alive?
No. Sadly not.
Yeah. Yeah, what an amazing way of being created to your connected to your ancestors and your inner history. So there's something systemic, isn't there?
There is. And again, I think the process of discovery has been around, you know, really making those connections with her and actually realizing how much of myself is because of her influence.
Yeah. I found a picture of my great-grandma in a box that I was sorting through the other day, and she's got these glasses. if you put me and her next to each other, you go, whoa.
There's no doubt, yeah.
But it's also interesting that what goes, you know, style and trend and fashion and things change, don't they? But it was a very beautiful thing. There's something, isn't there, about being able to reconnect with our story.
Yes.
That makes us, I think, stronger in terms of being human people.
Without doubt. Without doubt.
So, Julie, if people want to get in touch with you, I'll put details of the show in the show notes. And if they want to talk to you about improv or about coaching or about research, how do they get in touch with you?
The best way, Claire, is via LinkedIn. So Julie Flower on LinkedIn, and I'm sure, I don't think there are many Julie Flowers, but they'll work out which one it is.
I'll pop that in the show notes as well.
Thank you.
So thank you so much. So many insights for me to go away and think about, and I'm sure also for our listeners.
Thank you, Claire. So, it's been lovely to talk to you.
So thank you for coming to the Coaching Inn, and everyone else, thank you for listening. Remember to subscribe or follow if you want to get a new episode as they drop. We'll be back next week. Have a good one. Thank you all. Bye-bye.
If you've enjoyed what you've heard today, we'd love you to share the podcast with a friend or leave a comment on social media. And if you'd like to become a regular at the Coaching Inn, you can subscribe on Podbean and all major podcast channels. We look forward to welcoming you next time. You've been listening to The Coaching Inn, 3D Coaching's virtual pub. For more information, check out 3dcoaching.com.